was enough drop speed that they couldn't shoot you or falling too fast. If you did it wrong, because it's a two-blade helicopter, the blades would flex if they stopped and you could cut the tail of the helicopter off. This wasn't anything they were trained on. It was taught by other guys there, and they'd say, this is what we do so don't get shot.
Welcome to the Aviation Mentors Podcast, the podcast that takes your dreams of flight and turns it into reality.
Sponsored by Strass Financial, financing your flight training.
For pilots, by pilots. I'm Brandon Martini, a commercial pilot and flight instructor.
And I'm Carson Vasquez, I'm a private pilot.
Whether you're a seasoned pilot or beginner with dreams of flight,
Aviation Mentors is your source for expert insights, industry trends, and inspiring stories.
So fasten your seatbelts and prepare for this incredible journey through the skies.
And stay connected with us on social media for exclusive content.
And visit our website at www.aviationmentors.com. And let us be your co-pilot on this adventure. Welcome back, everybody, to another amazing and, of course, awesome episode of the Aviation Mentors Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. If you're joining us via video today, you're going to notice we have a guest on video in-house today, Carson.
Yeah, I know. It's the first time we're just talking about it. We haven't had anyone in our studio. And we haven't had anyone in our studio to such an extent that last night I had to make a run to Best Buy and grab a new mic and new headset, and headset came on Amazon about 5 minutes before we started setting up, so that was perfect.
That was pretty impressive, because I don't know how that would have worked out.
Yeah, I was just winging it.
Oh, I like that with the aviation term, winging
it. Yeah, it makes more sense.
So welcome, Dave. This is Dave Granville, everybody. Dave's been a family friend. He was friends with my dad probably before I was born. He likes to joke that I used to change my diapers, even though he looks young. I might have more gray in my beard than he does at this point. And that's all because of Carson, by the way.
Yeah, I met Dave about 2 or 3 years ago, and he's got a lot grayer since then. So there's a common thread here.
So welcome to the podcast, Dave. Thanks so much for joining.
Thanks for the welcome. I'm happy to be here. Happy to be an in-house guest. It's pretty cool.
You know, it did help that you live like a mile from here or less, huh?
It does help. It does help.
Yeah, I'm not sure how it's his first time on the podcast, too.
I know. He's going to be like a regular guest.
I better have something good to say.
Oh, there's a lot of good stuff to say. I have a feeling.
Because you see the notepad? That means it's going to be a good episode.
There was too many things that I had to remember, and I wanted to try and touch base on a lot of them, so we had to make notes.
I have a strong feeling this is going to be a multi-part series. We're going to have a part one and a part two at some point. It just feels that way.
Welcome to potentially part one of our interview with Dave.
Dave, so welcome over here. And I wanted to hear a little bit about, obviously, I know a lot about your aviation journey and how aviation is threaded through your family, but our listeners do not. And I don't know if Carson really knows the extent of how much aviation kind of threads through your family extensively. And the first thing I want to say, this episode is going to be dedicated to Dave's late father, Joe Connolly. He was an amazing man. He was the only man who let me fly his airplane besides him. He let me go fly it with Dave once, let me go fly it with him. He let me fly it solo. And he is very much so missed. So just wanted to tell you this episode's definitely dedicated to Joe.
Thanks, Brandon. I appreciate that. And I'm sure he would too. He was a neat guy. We all loved him. To start with my aviation side of my family, I was lucky. I come from several war heroes. My grandfather being the first on my mom's side, he was a infantry guy that glided into Nazi-occupied territory in Europe and did reconnaissance for 3 weeks and lived. And they basically crashed into the snow, buried the glider, and went to work. He made it out, went through the Battle of the Bulge after that, and was an amazing, nice, sweet guy for all the bad things that he had seen. And he was also very respected by my father, who was also a military hero. My dad, Joe, graduated high school in 1966 and decided that he wanted to enlist into the military versus being drafted because he had a better chance of becoming a pilot. He joined the Army right after high school, went in and went to Fort Walters for helicopter training.
Where's Fort Walters at?
I honestly don't know, but I know that's where he started his training. And then he finished at Fort Rucker. We have a solo hat right here, which states when he soloed. This is his solo hat. He gave it to me before he passed away. It's kind of a special thing.
Let's check that out. Let's see it. Yeah. By the way, I checked where Fort Walters is at. And if it's the one that I could find, it's in Texas, actually. You should see this hat. It is so cool. I mean, it looks like a normal hat from the outside, right? Except for it has a big S. What'd you say the S stood for?
Solo.
Solo. And inside the hat, I mean, I don't know if you can tell on the video, but the way that this hat was built is unreal. It has
they don't make them like that.
They don't make them like that anymore.
They literally don't make them like this anymore. And it had leather. So, you know, like the sweatbands that you have like nowadays in a normal hat, this actually has like a leather band.
To make you sweat more?
To make you sweat more.
I think it makes you sweat more. It doesn't soak it in.
You said that he was flying. What was he flying?
He was flying a TH-55 when he soloed. It says it right on the inside of the hat. It says he soloed at 11:40 a.m. on May 17th, 1967, and it has the helicopter TH-55A. I don't know, is that a tail number?
They put AC, so it means aircraft, 18278. So that might have been the serial number.
Gotcha.
If it was, we could probably look it up, which would be pretty cool to see if it's still around or if it's been scrapped.
Insane.
After the episode, we'll
check that out. Those helicopters got pretty beat up. those helicopters they had to auto-rotate into the ground in and learn a lot of different things in.
By the way, on that helicopter, I looked it up before because I was curious if there was, I don't know if I knew what kind of helicopter it was because I had no idea. I'm not a military aviator. And we looked it up and it's the equivalent of a Schweizer 300. So if you're familiar with a Schweizer 300, that's probably the, I don't know if it's the second most used aircraft for helicopter training. R-22 is obviously the most, and maybe the R-44. But a Schweizer 300 is actually what I was working on my helicopter rating on when I did my first like 10 hours. And I never, newsflash.
Why didn't you finish?
Somebody else was soloing kind of like a week or two before I was going to solo. Mm-hmm. And she split the skids. She put it down a little too hard. And that school never bought an airplane. And I didn't want to go to another airport because I was always at Riverside. So I didn't end up getting to finish. But it was really cool when I found that out today that he learned to fly a helicopter and soloed in the same exact helicopter that I started learning how to fly.
That's really cool.
So and he was around when I was flying that helicopter too.
He was.
Yeah. So I wish I would have told him about that. It would have been a cool experience to share.
Just to show the speed of how everything went. He graduated high school in 1966. He soloed in May of 1967. He went to Fort Rucker after that and did his Huey training. And by the end of 1967, he was in combat in Vietnam, flying missions.
So a year after high school.
Year after high school. And he was in the middle of it.
And 19 years old.
19 years old. And his first tour, I had some discussions with his good friend, Rick, which we'll talk further about later. And Rick said, you know, he gave me some information. I had some information in regards to his first tour. His first tour was wicked. He went there, flew some light combat missions. And by the time the Tet Offensive started, I don't know if anybody knows what that is, but Tet was a holiday. And that's when the war went sideways in Vietnam. And for those that know, that's when Lyndon B. Johnson resigned over that whole Tet Offensive. But it was really bad. They went through a lot of fire. I only heard a few stories from my dad, and he said one of the things they would do, they would have to go in and drop guys off and pick guys up, and you had to fly no matter what. And he said there was protocol that, you know, fuel hit a certain point or anything, they were supposed to go back. And he goes, but sometimes you just couldn't. You just had to fly. And he said one of the things that they would do is when they were going in to pick guys up, they would be drawing so much small arms fire. He goes, you could hear it and feel it hitting the helicopters you were flying. And he goes, so we would cut power slightly. We'd turn the helicopter 90 degrees so it was up on its side, and we just let it fall. And he goes, we would start at about 3,000, 3,500 feet, and we just let it fall. Just before it hit the ground, we'd have to power hard, and we'd flare the nose up. And we'd hit the ground. And he goes, that was enough drop speed that they couldn't shoot. You were falling too fast. And he said they'd come back out. And then I was talking to Rick last night, and Rick was saying that if you did it wrong, because it's a two-blade helicopter, the blades would flex if they stopped and you could cut the tail of the helicopter off.
Oh, geez.
So these guys were good. And they also said, and I read about it also, that this wasn't anything they were trained on. It was taught by other guys there, and they'd say, this is what we do so we don't get shot.
Wow.
It's just something they figured out.
That's something they figured out, that they could make the helicopter fall. And so the rate of descent would be the weight of the helicopter as fast as it could fall to the ground. And then they'd power up just before they hit the ground and hit it on the skids. Most of their time on the ground was not more than 20 seconds. So they would load in or load out in 20 seconds. I can only confirm that he was shot down three times.
Only confirm.
Only three times?
But that even Rick said that there was way more than that he had been shot down. And so they would just basically crash into the jungle and luckily live and usually get picked up by another helicopter that was coming through. He also crashed several times in Vietnam due to maintenance. Anybody that knows anything about helicopters, I do not. I only know from stories that I've heard. But anytime you get a hydraulic light, you instantly have to put the helicopter down as quickly as possible. He said there was many times that you'd see a hydraulic light and you couldn't land. And you're just hoping the crew chief's running around trying to find out where the hydraulics are leaking from and see how far you can get. Because if you have hydraulic failure, then you're going to lose your pitch and everything else. So they would just put it into the jungle.
By the way, I went to Vietnam last year. I think I told you about that. And I didn't fly around Vietnam. I went there as like a trip with my business group. And I actually went into the edge of the jungle where the Kuchi tunnels were. And I'll tell you this, it was an eerie feeling knowing, and I thought about Joe when I was there. I was like, it's an eerie feeling that Americans were here and Americans that I know were here. And they were getting shot at here and falling from the sky and dying. And there's American blood on these areas. And then I went through one of the tunnels. And I just thought that, like, I can't believe that they were that small, first off. And I lost a whole bunch of weight so I could fit through the tunnel. I didn't do that on purpose.
And so it's like bare minimum tunnel for a person to fit through? Like,
Carson, I have a video of it. Okay. I will show you.
Yeah, you need to show me that.
And you get claustrophobic real quick. And they said they enlarged them for Americans to come visit. Yeah, that's what they said. And just knowing that like your dad and others crashed there and had to be extracted out of this.
Repeatedly. This is a common event.
Repeatedly.
Yeah, that's incredible. I can't even imagine. You know what time it is, Carson?
Time is it, Brandon?
It's time to talk about one of our favorite companies.
Which company would that be?
Aviation Mentors is excited to be sponsored by the one and only Stratus Financial, dedicated to supporting the next generation of future aviators.
You know, Stratus Financial really understands the financial challenges that students face in pursuing their aviation dreams. That's why they offer student loans specifically tailored to aspiring pilots.
With competitive rates and flexible repayment plans, Stratus Financial helps take your aviation education to new heights.
So go visit their website today at www.stratus.finance. Just to be clear, that is not .com, it's .finance. And embark on your journey towards a sky full of possibilities.
Carson, it's time to get back to what we do best.
The show.
Yeah, and they had crash protocol with radios and things like that because they didn't want the enemy to get their radios and things like that. And he goes, if you were too deep into things, you may have to destroy a perfectly good helicopter just so that the enemy couldn't get it. And he said they would blow and go, get out. And I don't know exactly what the whole protocol was to destroy a helicopter or at least damage the radios enough that they couldn't be used. But he said you'd have to do that and get out. He said he also ran out of fuel, even though they had fuel protocols that they couldn't go past. He said when you had to get guys out, it was like, oh, crap, we got to keep going. And he said, you know, sometimes you'd only take guys a half mile. So you'd pick them up, pull them out, go a half mile, dump them, go back. And then you go, okay, I can pick these guys up, I can drop them, and I can go back. And he goes, you'd get altitude and then all of a sudden there would be a mechanical or could be fuel, could be anything. And he goes, you just auto rotate. He goes, sometimes you'd be overweight. So you're overweight and you're trying to auto rotate into the jungle. And he goes, there was times when you would come into these treetops and you knew that you were chopping trees. And he said, you could hear the trees getting cut by your rotor blades. He said, also they'd land and there'd be holes and chips and pieces of shrap metal stuck in the blades. And he goes, we'd look at the blades and go, thank God these things stayed together and got us back. One of the things that he said was that the Huey was such a capable aircraft. He goes, after flying the TH-55s and you get in that, he goes, it was like getting to a Cadillac. He goes, you had jet power and the turbine could just throttle that thing anywhere and do anything. And we had just an angle of attacks that other helicopters couldn't do. It's different. It's not like the newer helicopters you can fly inverted or things like that. But at that time, it was the most capable thing out there.
And they're still flying them locally around here.
Still flying them locally. While I was riding all this, guys, I have to say this. I had my window open. Of course, I live right up the street. And I'm riding this, and I can hear a two-blade helicopter because I grew up in it my whole life. And I could hear a two-blade helicopter flying up the beach. And I look out, and it's a freaking Huey while I was riding this.
That's impactful.
It was very, very. I mean, I actually welled up. My wife's like, what's wrong with you?
and they go out of Los Alamitos. I live in the northern part of Huntington when I'm in California, and I get to see those Hueys come out of Los Alamitos. And I know they go down to the training grounds in
Camp Pendleton.
Yeah, Camp Pendleton area.
I'll speak about Los Al a little bit more as we get further.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, it's super interesting to how much he loved that aircraft. I think because it saved him.
Oh, I'm sure.
I mean, if I had to pre-flight a plane and there was that many issues with it every time when I got back, you know, like I had shrapnel that was literally in my propellers, I don't think there's anything I would do more than love that plane for getting me back and forth right. every time.
Okay. Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, speaking of picking up these guys in the Tet Offensive and how badly that, you know, how many guys were lost and things like that, I was lucky enough that my wife, Debbie, her dad, Ed, was infantry. And I had a comment. He met my dad and knew my dad. And I had a conversation one time and he goes, the rotor blades of a Huey were like music. He said that music was a song that said, you might live.
Wow.
It was super cool to hear Ed talk about it and say, man, if you heard the rotor blades, it was like, okay, these guys are going to get us out of here. And he goes, that music of that Huey coming over. And he goes, those gunships just firing, just causing flak to get everybody so that they could come in. And I didn't understand the whole concept when they would do that drop that I talked about. That was only single ship, because there was times when they were coming in four or five at a time in formation and they would come in close. They would bring a smaller helicopter, and I wish I could remember the name of it, in underneath them to draw flak, to draw fire.
Wow.
And so those guys would go in and they would draw fire, and then the gunships would be above. And in the beginning they were called something B. I forget what they're called, but they were the original gun, the Huey gunships, and they originated firing those in. Later on, the Cobras came in, and the Cobras were the gunship, which is the narrow, your pilots in the back and your gunners in the front. But the gunships would come in and they just lay fire. The guy would come in, the small helicopter would come in the bottom and draw fire on that side, and then they'd bring the passenger carriers in to pull guys out or put them in and then get out. But the amazing thing to me is they would have up to 9 guys in a helicopter and they wouldn't spend more than 20 seconds on the ground. So those guys would evacuate out, or they would put wounded in. Was reading things that they had protocols that they said that when these guys would come in under fire, that the deal was with the infantry soldiers, you had to stand up and load. If you weren't willing to stand up and load, we're not willing to hit the ground, because we're all going to get shot. So if we're going to get shot, we all got to pull our part. And he goes, you know, you could hit the ground and these guys wouldn't get off the ground. And you're like, your crew chief has to get out that's actually running the helicopter and help load these guys into the helicopter. And he goes, you lose your crew chief, it could be disastrous. So they talk about gunners. They said that, you know, they'd get gunners on the helicopters and guys would get in and they'd want to run the guns, even though they weren't gunners on an aircraft, because they were all hyped up and jamming. He goes, and that was just on a sling. And he said that gun would swing up, and if they aimed up, they'd shoot the rotor blades. And so he said it would just be out of control, you know, when these things would go down. But that was his first tour, which was totally crazy. And I wish I had more information, and there's probably helicopter pilots out there that are going, no, that's not right. But this is just, I'm just going from the stories that I've heard. So very interesting stuff. Obviously I'm not a helicopter pilot. I only know from the stories. He came back after that and spent some time, and that's when he met my mother. And I had already been born. Joe's my stepdad. My father died when I was 16 months old, and he took over. He was the only guy I knew.
And what a guy he was. I actually saw, before I came into the office this morning, I went into my office, and I don't know why I'm getting goosebumps even thinking about it. I went into my office at my house. I'm at the Newport office right now. But I went into the office and I saw a picture of Joe from his memorial. It was super cool. And I walked out, and that was kind of the last thing I saw when I left my office. And I didn't even think anything of it this morning until right now when you said it. For some reason, that just kind of popped up in my office. And I've had it sitting there for a while on my whiteboard, and I've kept it there. It was on my whiteboard at NextGen when that was my normal office. And I moved it to my house and I put it on my other whiteboard, and it sits there. So it's a cool memory that I get to see every once in a while. And
that's awesome. I mean, this is obviously an amazing episode to do, especially for you guys. Yeah. It's a lot of memories.
Yeah. A lot of memories, a lot of good memories, a lot of crazy stuff. Like I was saying, when I got in here, guys, I've learned so much over the last couple of weeks, just studying up on some of the stuff that I didn't know, or I barely knew. You know, guys went through a lot of stuff. When my dad came back from that first tour, he met my mom, they ended up getting married, and then he had to go on his second tour. And when he went on his second tour, I believe that was 69-70, when he went on his second tour. His second tour was much less battle oriented. I think he had taken so much at the first time around. They gave him a little bit more of a cush job. When he got there, he was checked out in the CH-47s, which is a Chinook. The Chinooks came in and did a little bit more of reconnaissance, transporting troops from area to area, hauling materials. You know, he said that they would actually steal Jeeps from other areas. And he goes, we'd take the Jeep, we'd drive into the back of the Chinook and we'd take off. And he goes, and we'd go back and land back at our base. And then we'd spray paint the bumper and we'd put numbers on it that matched our battalion and put it back. And he goes, who would know?
That is so funny.
He said that the Air Force base was next to where they were and Air Force had all the good stuff. He goes, so we go over there and we'd fly in and they had pallets of plywood. And he goes, we didn't have any plywood where we were at. We all lived in tents. And he goes, so we would fly over at night. We'd put a spotlight out. The crew chief would drop down a rope. We'd go it and we'd tie off one of their pallets and we'd literally just carry it off.
No way.
And so he told some pretty good stories. But when he was in that area, that's when he met Rick Dickinson. Rick Dickinson is a great guy. Rick filled me in on a lot of these stories and things like that. He said they had a great relationship and he just could not talk more about how great of a pilot my dad was and what an aviator he was. You know, they continued being friends for life. But during that time, Rick said that your dad had been through so much that when we slept at night, every once in a while, there would mortar rounds would get tossed into where we lived. He said, so I took the runway plates, you know, the steel World War II runway plates. And he goes, so I stacked them around my cot underneath and up against the side of the tent. And he goes, when I'd hear mortar rounds, I'd roll off the bed and roll off my cot onto the ground so I'd be protected by the mortar rounds. He goes, your dad would look at me and stand up, walk over to the refrigerator and grab a beer and look at me and go, what's wrong, Rick? He goes, your dad was just, it had gone through a totally different experience in Vietnam than I had. So he was a lot more fearless. He talked about they flew Hueys at that point. He said at that point, my dad's rank, they could both pretty much fly whatever they wanted. So my dad flew as a gunner and a Cobra for a little while, not on heavy missions, but he actually rode the nose and was a gunner in the Cobra, which is pretty cool. He flew the Chinooks and then they flew the Hueys. He said, when we flew Hueys, we weren't really flying into battle too much. We were doing things like resupplies. So if we did have to go into to supply guys, he goes, first thing we would do if we knew guys had been hit hard and they had been pulled off is we'd fly to the officers club. We'd literally put a pallet of beer in the helicopter, the stuff that we were transporting. And then he goes, we'd get in, we'd hit the ground, we'd unload these guys with beer and their supplies. And they thought we were the greatest thing in the world and we'd get out.
That's awesome.
So that was one of the things that that Rick was talking about last night. He goes, it was kind of like our norm. We would go to the officers club. We'd load up as much beer and soda or whatever we thought that they would like. And he goes, we'd fly out into the jungle and drop these guys off with all this stuff. So it's pretty entertaining. He said that portion of it was a little bit more cush. They did have some things that they flew through, but not to the extent that his first tour was. They also said, I thought this was pretty interesting, that they had an air conditioner. And they had an air conditioner, which was a rarity in Vietnam.
In the helicopter?
On the tent.
In the tent.
In the tent. And they said that they were so afraid that it wouldn't work again that they kept it on all the time. And he said it would get so cold in the tent that they would have to get extra blankets from the supply guys. And he goes, everybody else is, it's 90 degrees and 90% humidity. And he goes, we're asking for extra blankets in our tent. He goes, but we had that air conditioner. We were afraid to turn it off because we were afraid if it failed, we wouldn't have anything else in it from there. So that was the second tour he did in Vietnam, and he was a great aviator there and did all that. He came back from that tour, and we moved to Fort Sill, Oklahoma.
And you know what, Dave? They're going to have to hear about that in part two.
Because we have talked too much.
Come on.
Sorry, guys.
I don't even want to do a part two. I just want to keep listening, dude. Why do you got to do this? No. Go on.
Hey, everybody. So thanks so much. You're going to have to hear this in part two. Listen for next week. Enjoy the episode. Thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody, for listening.
I don't have anything else to say. I'm just bummed.
Bye, guys.
Bye, guys. Take care.